Hello and welcome to the Super Show podcast. Today, a show which is going to be as slick and as tight as its co-host Jamie, because there's not been much news going on. But we are a video game podcast. Hello and welcome if you are joining us on YouTube or if you're joining us later on podcasting platforms. But Jamie, slick and tight, that is how I'm, yeah. That's what I'm calling you. How are you doing?
I was trying to figure out if that was an oxymoron, but it's not. Something can be both slick and tight, I guess. I don't think I've ever been described as either. Definitely not tight. I'm more like the... I take slick and flabby, maybe if we did a little reworking.
Nah, you are tight like a tiger. It's all good.
Now we're starting to get into weird territory that maybe reveals a little bit too much about our relationship. Careful, Jonesy. Don't say anything on the internet that you want to take back later, because you can't.
That is some very, very good advice. But moving away from internet advice, how about some internet news? Because today we're going to be hitting you with a few different news stories. As I said, there's not much going around, but we've picked a few more stories than normal, and we're going to go through these. So we're going to be talking about Stellar Blade being uncensored all over the world. We're going to be talking about GTA 5 and some possible cancelled DLC that we never got to see, and a Ubisoft leaker has been giving us some juicy little tidbits that we're going to get into. And we're going to be talking about Embracer not being so embracing anymore, as they've had to split up into multiple companies. But all that and more for the next, your guess is as good as mine, hour, 2 hours. We'll see. We'll see how this goes.
Yeah.
So let's jump straight in. Actually, no, what am I doing? I've completely messed up. I've got to do the housekeeping bits at the beginning. We are at Super Show Pod on YouTube and on Twitter. We are available across all major podcasting platforms. So you can watch us on YouTube, or you can find us on those audio-only platforms, depending on how you'd like to listen to us. We are also on paisleyradio.com on Thursdays at 10 p.m., repeated Mondays at 10 p.m. But first up, Jamie, much like us, much like the Super Show podcast, Stellar Blade is uncensored in all regions, worldwide. It's going international.
Technically, we are. You're right. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, and it's garnered a little bit of criticism. Well, not Stellar Blade, I should say. The censors have garnered a little bit of criticism, and this is because other games have not benefited from that same thing. So let's get into this. So basically, Stellar Blade has come out with a C0D, if that's how you say it, C-E-R-O-D rating in Japan, which means that it cannot be purchased by players unless they are under 17 years of age, unless they've got parental consent. So I suppose that's like a 17A. An adult's got to tell you that you can do it.
Yeah, I guess so.
I suppose. But that means that it can be released in Japan completely uncensored. They're going to leave everything in the game. Nothing's getting taken out. You just have to be over 17 or have an adult say that it's cool, which is surprising for Japan, maybe.
Yeah, especially given, and I'm learning some of this kind of on the fly as we investigate this story in particular, Japan's history of maybe being slightly less lenient when it comes to other countries and other content rating systems and organizations. I'm happy to go with zero. That seems zero. Logical. The Computer Entertainment Rating Organization. I have no idea why the Japanese one is all English words, but there you go. There probably is. In fact, shall I try the Japanese version?
Oh, yes, please.
They've got like the Hepburn, which is when they spill it out in kind of like English. And so it's the Tokutai Hiri Katsudo Hojin Computer Entertainmento Retingo Kiko.
I can see why they go zero.
Yeah, I can see that as well. But I do like that there were some words in there, kind of like Metaro Gear Solido, where it's like, oh, that kind of just sounds like someone doing an unfortunate and potentially offensive impression. But actually, computer is actually, it's just the word. I'm not being racist, I promise.
I suppose if you literally don't have a word for something, then to just import a different word from a different language makes total sense. Like, we do that with pajamas, right? That's not an English word. Isn't that Indian, yeah. I think? Or something?
I can believe it.
I think shampoo is as well. Croissant.
Does that work?
Croissant's French.
Yeah.
Yeah, but because we don't say it like a French person. We don't go like, croissant.
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I
maybe.
Do. And I get some weird looks every now and then when people ask me where I'm going on holiday, and I go, I'm going to Paris.
Don't Americans say croissant? I think they pronounce this croissant as well. Croissant.
Stop, I could have jumped my croissant. Yeah, that sounds about right. I'm relying on my Vine memory there, but yes.
So yeah, so the reason that Stellar Blade on the censors have had a little bit of a pushback on this is because often when a PlayStation game comes out, they have regional variations based on what the censors have said. And in this particular instance, the makers of Dead Space were pretty annoyed because when they tried to release the game in Japan, they were told that because of dismembered limbs and sort of general gruesomeness, they would not be allowed to release the game with a 0D rating, and that in order to release the game at all, they would have to make cuts, they would have to make changes. And they've actually, since Stellar Blade has come out,
It was the EA Japan's general manager.
Thank you. My eyes are not working for me as I'm trying to figure. Oh, yes. Sean Noguchi, who's gone onto X to complain and actually provide the receipts as well, because he's put up screenshots that show dismemberment, slices of body and gruesomeness that is in Stellar Blade, which is exactly the content that they weren't allowed to have included in Dead Space. So a little bit of an unfair implementation of the rules, Jamie.
Yeah, a little bit of a double standard, because again, I don't know if this is kind of a funny quirk of something being directly translated, but there was a particular focus on what Sean kept referring to as the cross section, the idea that when something gets like sliced open or split open, and therefore you see kind of internal organs, or you might see exposed bones, things like that, that is clearly something that, or that is clearly the line where Japanese censors kind of, that's drawn for violence, in kind of, you either fall the right side of that or you fall the wrong side of it. And to be fair, on the evidence as presented, and you know, sometimes we don't know what's going on the other side of these, within these censorship organizations, there have been entire documentaries made about, you know, certain Western ratings agencies and kind of how discreet and obscure they are, and how they never reveal their way of working or who their members are completely anonymous. So it could be, I don't want to get into conspiracy theory territory, but it does appear to be a bit of a double standard. The only thing that I can think to point to when it comes to kind of things I've looked at that are, I'm not going to call them research, though. This isn't a kind of podcast that gets that we do any research for, but there may well be
brutal.
Well, it's true. Like, we should.
No, I'm not. I'm not calling you out or saying you're wrong. I'm just saying
we're two random people sitting down and talking about games. We don't need to do any homework.
Hello.
And to be fair, I know, for example, I've read many BBFC kind of categorizations in the past, and that's the one that we have here in the UK. And they, for example, they're always quite keen to determine the sort of the tone, I guess, with which certain, you know, scenes of violence or action or even sex and drug use kind of take place within. And one thing that I feel like I'm seeing, and this is kind of backed up by the Dead Space situation, is that sort of very dark horror games seem to get treated slightly more harshly than perhaps other titles might be. The Callisto Protocol, for example, actually never even got released in Japan, as far as I can tell. They cancelled that game's release when it didn't receive a 0 rating due to the game's violent content, and the developer essentially refused to make the cuts that would have been necessary to get it one.
Right.
The Last of Us Part 2, another horror game of a sort, ended up getting a 0Z rating, which is the ages 18 and up only. It's the highest you can get while still being legal, and even that they had to make cuts to get it. So there is maybe an underlying element here where maybe they've seen some of the Stellar Blade content, whether it's the character design, enemy design, world design, or just general tone and themes of the game. They've looked at it and said, actually, they're slightly lighter, maybe more science fiction or science fantasy than, you know, survival horror, and that maybe has made them slightly more lenient. Or it could just be the case that this is like a weird, and it shouldn't be this way, but it could be a slightly more individual thing. Like, you got the wrong censor on the wrong day and they didn't like what they saw. Oftentimes you don't know whether these people are playing these games or whether they're being served pre-packaged and pre-edited sequences from these games that are supposed to represent the extremes of that violence. And in that case, it's like, what are the differences in these packages and who's making them? There are so many variables that it can be hard to, you know, call foul play off the bat. That being said, you do have to feel a little bit for Sean in this case, where you know, Ciro pointed towards something that he can explicitly say is present in another title. It's one of those things where I think there probably should be more onus on whether it's Ciro or whether it's BBFC, Peggy, ESRB. There probably should be more of a process where they might have to defend their actions or explain. Complete sidetrack, but there's a huge conversation going on in England at the moment and around parts of Europe around like the quality of refereeing in football or soccer and the reliability and the consistency of VAR, which is the virtual assistant referee, and how easy it is theoretically for like the referees or the refereeing groups and organizations to kind of like basically scurry away after matches. Referees never do interviews, they're never held accountable, a referee has never been fired for what is theoretically poor job performance.
Right.
You know, sometimes organizations like these just kind of like they're a necessity, but that necessity is something that they can almost hide behind and never really have to answer for what might actually be errors in their working or inconsistencies in their determinations.
I think you make a good point. Because yeah, you can never actually know. If you never know why they've made a decision, it's also got to be difficult when you're producing the content in the first place. You might be thinking, oh, we're gonna skip by this, and then you get caught up in some sort of classification, some sort of censorship that you didn't think you were going to fall under. I do have a quote here in from Sean who said, Ciro. So this is directed straight at them. You said that our dead space was no good because the cross-section of damaged parts and internal organs were visible. But here you can see both the cross-sections and insides, so I'm not convinced you are using Ciro-D. I have a question based on that quote, though.
Yeah.
Do you think that maybe Ciro are getting confused when they were looking at the game and when they were looking at internal organs, they were just looking at the very, very tight, skimpy outfits that even her cohorts wear and were getting confused?
I don't know. Maybe they were distracted by those tight outfits. Maybe they saw other appendages and didn't notice the exposed cross-sections of some of Eve's enemies laying in the background.
Yeah, maybe they were looking really close and thinking, well, I can't see any of her internal organs. Yeah. I don't see what the problem is. And then, but it was all the scattered body parts that they were
supposed
to be
looking at. And also, you don't know who the person is. I can't remember what the name of it was, but I remember watching a documentary. I think it probably came out about 20 years ago. That was an investigation into the ratings agency for American motion pictures and trying to determine why they were so, you know, discreet and why their identities were hidden and why they never like had to justify their decisions. They just gave you a rating, and if you didn't like it, fuck it, you have to resubmit with a different cut. And that was end of conversation. And like one of the things in that documentary, and it could apply here to Ciro or any agency that we're talking about, is like you also don't know who's on the other side. It could be someone like you or I who is tapped into the culture or the scene or the industry. It could very easily, though, much like, you know, when we talk about the people who are voting for Oscars, be someone who's 90 and has no idea what's going on and hasn't played a game for, you know, 17 years. And it's like, oh, what is this? Is this what the kids nowadays want? Tits and
It couldn't be us. I mean, my brain, I'm so dead inside at this point that I could see almost anything and not, I'd put PG, that's fine, and people would be horrified. Actually, talking PG, I actually had there's an interesting little tidbit. This is my one olive branch to Ciro about the reason maybe that they've rated the two things differently, because recently I was reading an article about the UK BBFC, Jamie, as you were talking about, because they've actually recently changed the rating of the film Mary Poppins, a beloved children's film made in the 70s, I believe it was, the original, not the new one, which used to be a U. It was made in 1964, my mistake. It was originally a U for Universal in the UK, but it was recently regraded to be a PG. And that was because they've said... And they were actually being quite open and upfront and transparent about how they rate things and why they feel things are different. And what they basically said was times change. And actually things that were acceptable a few years ago or that we wouldn't consider something to push it into a higher category. Obviously, we expect that to move in one direction, right? We expect that things get more lenient, but actually some things don't. Some things move the other way. But yeah, so maybe there's a possibility that Ciro-D have tweaked their what they find acceptable in the modern day and age.
It's very totally possible. And it was also one of those things where, again, I'm not familiar enough of Ciro and their processes to know how public that kind of documentation maybe is, for example. But like, yeah, maybe things have changed behind the scenes. Maybe kind of the line has moved slightly. Maybe that's communicated to developers. Maybe it's not. It's interesting. I occasionally get close to the to this side of things in my line of work. I've never been a part of the submission process or the approval process, but I've been a part of the trailer making process, in which you often have to be very careful about. For me, mostly working with Peggy and ESRB, and they have very specific rules about where those logos or those icons are placed, whether at the beginning of their full screen or if they're in the corner, and how long they're on for, and having the Peggy 16 voice alongside it, with things about how much of the screen it takes up and all that kind of, it's all very exacting. But every time I've done a trailer that is for a Japanese version of a storefront, which is usually only really Nintendo, because Nintendo are the only ones where they have, in my experience, have different specifications for the eShop per continent, basically. Well, we do Europe, America, and Japan. Japan is the one where it's just unrated. We don't put the Zero on there or anything like that. Like, we only right. ever submit unrated, quote unquote, unrated trailers, which is usually fine. And I think that's only not fine if your game is an adult game that has like a Peggy 18 or something like an equivalent right. of that. In that case, I think you have to have a full screen certificate at the beginning before like the trailer starts, so people can't start accidentally watching something that they're not supposed to watch and then look at the icon in the corner to realize. It gets weird.
It's interesting as well, because if you'd have asked me, I would have thought that like Japanese horror is one of like the darkest and most terrifying horror right. genres out there. Like, I mean, I always think of American version of Japanese horror films as being the more censored. They're sanitized in some way, and I don't think of Americans stuff as being particularly heavy on censorship when it comes to like gore yeah. and violence. So yeah, I'm actually quite surprised thinking about it that they've gone in this direction. But hey,
can I ask you about your thoughts on a theory that's a little bit tinfoil hatty?
You know you can.
Okay.
Go for it.
So obviously, games that are released in Japan are subject to this process all the time. Every game that we've played this year, it's been released in Japan, it went through this process, yeah? But we very rarely hear about a game, being kind of like censored or uncensored. And so in theory, like the official Stellar Blade account has gone out there and said, Stellar Blade is going to be uncensored in all countries, including the Japan version. No one else is doing that. Like, when, again, it doesn't matter how adult, like we could have been playing, like, I've been playing, like, Rise of the Ronin recently. There's plenty of blood and plenty of gore in that. But, like, they didn't feel the need to tweet and go out, yeah, it's uncensored in all countries. And even if you go and look at the tweet from the official Stellar Blade account, they put some really weird image with it, with this big red cross that says, uncensored all countries. Do you think there's a part of them that are using this announcement that is ostensibly just about, hey, the Japanese censors told us we didn't have to remove any violence, and using it to try and win internet brownie points with the people who are hoisting up Stellar Blade as like a victory for anti-DEI and pro-women with big tits and big... like, the whole crowd that are using Stellar Blade and Eve's character design as like a pushback and like a victory for the industry that is going in this horrible direction... Do you think they're kind of feeding into that shit show with a tweet like this that is ostensibly irrelevant to everyone in the West?
No.
Okay.
I think that's accurate, but for a different reason. And I think they're appealing to a different audience. I don't think they're appealing to the anti-DEI, the anti, like that sort of crowd at all.
Yeah.
And maybe this is just me being filth. I think it's appealing to the crowd who like a bit of Japanese adult material, which you may know out there, you may have stumbled upon it, is censored and specifically pixelated in certain ways so that you can't see certain things. And actually finding uncensored content like that of a Japanese nature is is more rare because they just don't make it, right? It's because they, in order to produce adult content, they have to censor it. And the way that they've, because I saw exactly the thumb you're talking about, and yeah, the way they've done that, I think what they're trying to angle for is almost
the mosaic effect.
Yes, I think they're maybe going for the idea of making in the back of your, because my mind went to this a little bit. It was like, what you've seen so far is the censored version of Stellar Blade, but we're allowed to put out the uncensored version of Stellar Blade. So I actually think it's a bit of a thirst trap.
Like, our porn is censored, but our video games aren't.
Yes.
See the real uncut Stellar Blade.
See all of Eve. See all of Eve.
DVDs used to do that all the time. Like, if there was a even a remotely raunchy teen-oriented film, it would always come out and have a cinematic release, and the DVD would always be like the uncut or the unrated edition, which basically, like, there's 10 more seconds of tits in this one. Go and get your friends.
I think it's going after the thirst views, and I think they're using that conversation. I don't think it is. I don't have the feeling at all that it's, as you said, it's that audience. I can see why people have said it, but to me, that feeds into like a different mindset, and I don't think that's what they're doing. I think if they're going for either crowd, they're going for the Eve sexy. You want to see her even less censored than you've seen her up to now? I think it's going for maybe that audience.
It's a big audience. Why not? We're kind of a bar. I like...
Me too. It's the Lara Croft swan diving into the water audience, and it's the Duke Nukem throwing money at the strippers in the club audience of video games, which is, hey, we're all there for a bit of fun as we're playing apparently a very good video game.
You can have great gameplay and great eye candy at the same time.
Absolutely you can. But Jamie, we're talking obviously about censorship, about all these, the fact that this is uncensored. Do you know who else is uncensored?
Who?
They are our patrons who have gone over to patreon.com/supershow to support us. And they can join the Discord for the lowest tier level of $2. They can get on that Discord. Well, and ain't nobody censoring them as they do that.
I was going to say, is the Discord censored, or can people say whatever they want?
They can say whatever they want. If they want, they can censor it themselves by using the spoiler tags. But apart from that, there ain't no... That's not even true. I'll censor you on the Discord if you say something really bad. I'll just take it on.
That was a bit of a self-inflicted blow for a second there. You can't say absolutely anything on the Discord. We do have limits.
We don't have to worry about that anyway. We've got good people on there. If you want to have a good conversation about video games or about anything else, head over to there to our Patreon, join up, and you can join our Discord, like I said, and you can talk to some amazing people. There are some awesome people that have joined us in chat already, so I'm going to give a little shout out to them. We've got Davinat Coburn, we've got the Funky Penguin, Nick Leakes, Slick 1977, and Snifflebox all joining us live as we talk on the internets. But right now, I would also like to give a shout out to the patrons. There are some that you can see popped up on screen right now. Awesome, uncensorable individuals. I'm going to give a shout out to some as well. I'm going to give a shout out to Aaron Cameron, Athletic Gravy, Brimstone, Ice Nork Rock Salt, Jesper Camden Nielsen, Pastors Guild, and Xander GTI. And the most uncensorable of all, the members of the board, the big dogs, it's Brett Z, a.k.a. Shellshock, Geometric Potter, Hacksaw Book Reed, Manuel Guerrero, and Pease Wad. So thank you so much, everyone, for supporting us. We say every week, and we really do mean it, that it does mean a lot to us. It keeps us coming back. It keeps us being uncensored. I mean, that's not true, is it? We're super censored.
And also, the more you keep banging on about censorship, the more it starts to sound like we're going into some weird right-wing grifting territory where we're like, we're uncensorable. No one can shut us up because we're not what, like,
don't you've worry. Got you've got far so, right Jersey, over here. Jersey you've got
he found his segue and he stuck with it. That's all that was happening.
I did. Yeah. If you imagine, you've got far right over here, you've got far left over here, and there's us sitting right in the middle on the fence, not committing one way or the other, just enjoying video games. No, don't need any of that other shit in here.
I felt a little bit more comfortable before you even did that. Like, I.
What I before know. I said we were milk toast? we're not even in that continuum.
We've been on the internet for long enough by now. People know exactly where we're coming from.
This is probably true. Jamie,
actually, that's not even true. Sometimes I have been followed by people on Twitter or had my tweets liked by people on Twitter, and I've looked at their profile and I've gone, "Oh my god!" Like, I don't know what I said that made this person like my content, but we are not aligned politically speaking.
I don't think I've ever had, to be fair, you know what it is, I don't really look at other people's profiles just in case. That's probably what it is.
Honestly, it might be for the best, Jonesy. It might be.
Don't ask, don't tell. That's my policy.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Exactly. You set me up for a beautiful little segue there, and then we messed it up because we were talking about something else. No, do it again. No, because I cannot remember what it was. All I was going to say was, I want to hear about what you've been doing for the last week or so, what you've been playing, sure. What you've been watching.
Yeah, I mean, I've been kind of on top of a couple of new things, but there's only one thing that I really felt inspired, motivated to talk about on the podcast. And I want to clarify up front that it's not necessarily because I think it's an amazing game, but just because I think it's a very interesting game that I heard about first on a podcast. And the description of the game alone was enough for me to go out and do some of my own research and look into it a little bit more and ultimately pick it up. And that is a game called Life Eater that came out just about a week ago as we record this podcast. It is from Strange Scaffold, who aren't a developer that I'm super familiar with, although I believe, I'm actually just sort of fact-checking myself on the fly, they did develop a game last year that was pretty critically acclaimed called El Paso Elsewhere that has actually just been picked up for a movie adaptation, which was kind of cool news. But yes, Life Eater is their new game. And Jonesy, I wonder if this might pique your interest, if I told you that Strange Scaffold themselves on their Steam page, described the game as a horror fantasy kidnapping simulator.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And when I say that, when I say like fantasy kidnapping simulator, I'm sure a lot of people kind of apply maybe sort of a slightly over the top kind of like tonality or look to it, but no, they're like it is a really kind of rather dark and occasionally uncomfortable like kidnapping simulator where
I'm thinking of a game that was cancelled and removed from the Steam store because it was too far down that route, and that we've maybe should be mentioned, but I'm hoping it's not as dark as that.
Well, see, that this is the thing. I think there's always going to be conversations around these kinds of games, and how they handle that sort of that material.
Are you the kidnappee or the kidnapper?
You're the kidnapper.
Oh, okay, right.
You are playing as an unnamed man, or at least unnamed to the point that I'm at in the game. Who, and again, the game is sort of like very intentionally obscure with some of its information that it doles out, leaving some of the plot points to the player's imagination. But the game presents a character who, either literally in a fantastical sense, or because he's got some kind of like mental health issues, like maybe he's got schizophrenia, again, it's very open-ended, believes that he is in touch with or has been chosen by an evil kind of like a demon, like an overlord that has the power to bring about the apocalypse and end the world, and that it is his responsibility to every year abduct and ritually sacrifice and murder an unsuspecting person to appease this.
This is like full on paranoid schizophrenia sort of.
I think that's probably why they describe themselves as a horror fantasy kidnapping simulator. But when you play the game, it very much presents as, no, this is a character who, as you said, has like suffers from some kind of schizophrenia and has manifested or created this evil overlord that can bring about the apocalypse as an outlet for their abductions and murders.
But then, like, we've talked about this recently with the Hellblade and Hellblade 2 Senua's Saga. Like, that is actually quite, I suppose, depending on how you deal with it, but can be very interesting grounds for games to go into. So,
absolutely. Yeah. And like something that it doesn't feel like it's explored very often with a lot of maturity because it's so easy. Again, it all depends on the perspective you take. And like, do you remember a game called Hatred a couple of years ago?
Oh, vaguely.
It was like an isometric shooter that was basically, had a kind of interesting black and white or sort of monochromatic look, but was basically like, one guy decides, I hate this world and I hate everyone on it, so I'm going to pick up an AR and run around the streets and go postal.
Right.
But with none of the sense of humor or, you know, kind of nuance, that's a weird word to use, about the postal series. But you know what I mean.
Yeah, I get it.
None of the, like, yeah. I don't want to get into the postal, right? It's a weird series. So Life Eater is not a game that kind of like I think it sounds weird to say this as a way of defending the game, but it's not a game that focuses on like the violent acts themselves or the committing the acts of violence. You don't directly control any of the abductions or the murders.
Right.
It instead focuses on the kidnapping simulator part of things. This is a game, ostensibly a puzzle game, about studying people's routines, determining who to kidnap and when and sometimes how, and then also learning enough about their lives so that you can perform the ritual sacrifice at the end to the tune of your master.
See, do you know what's worrying to me is we've spoken before about the fact that I really like the idea and wanted to play for a long time a Sims style from like that sort of isometric top-down look serial killer simulator where you get to pick the type of serial killer you are and how you find your victims and stuff. I've always thought that'd be like an intriguing game, and this kind of sounds like it might be in a similar vein.
It doesn't nearly indulge in some of those ideas as much as I think your hypothetical game might.
Like, I don't want to do the stabby stabby part of a serial killer game. I just want to do
even planning or like choosing how you're going to kill someone, like it's not even that.
Sounds really bad, doesn't it? I just listened to myself say, I'm like, no, I'm not a crazy person.
Like, well, but like this is why I think these kinds of games have become a little bit taboo, is because they don't want to feed into that thing of becoming murder simulators or torture simulators.
Right.
Like torture scenes in general in video games, going all the way back to, you know, like you talk about the one in GTA 5, for example, one of the most commercially successful games of all time. They're controversial because they're interactive. I think Life Eater kind of walks a very interesting tightrope around the degree of interactivity that is appropriate in what is still quite an engaging story about someone who is committing these atrocities. I need to clear up the picture of how the game actually plays before people go out and buy it and go like, oh my God, what is this? Because it essentially plays out in two parts. It's part puzzle game, part visual novel.
Okay.
So the puzzle side of things is the abduction. So basically, your master, this overlord, will give you progressively more complicated instructions as each year rolls by, from just abduct someone to, like, you might have three people, and it's like abduct a loner who, like, no one is going to miss.
Right.
And things like that. And so basically what you have is imagine your potential abductee, and imagine a Premiere Pro timeline that makes up their daily routine. And
okay.
You have their daily routine for each day of the week. And you flip between the days of the week with Q and E. And each day you have that timeline stretching out horizontally, made up of all these blocks that are what they're doing, but they're all blurred out. You know, they're all fuzzy. And so what you have to do is you have to click on one of those blocks and try and figure out what that person does in that time slot. In any of those slots, you have a choice of three things to do, a level one, a level two, and a three option. And they're always kind of like, you know, watch them from your car, send them a phishing email, like go pretend to be a door-to-door salesman, accuse them of
to try and figure out what they do at that time of their time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
timeline. All these different, but each of those three level options will have a higher likelihood of success, but as you do things, you're arousing more suspicion.
Right.
And you have a suspicion meter that fills. If your suspicion meter fills three times, you fail because you, I guess, have been arrested. And you can take, you can ease off or reduce your suspicion meter by doing these kind of like, what are theoretically kind of like more relaxing, non-abducting, but they're also kind of creepy because you're playing a fucking weirdo.
Right.
So, but that's where you get into the most important currency of them all, which is time. So every act you do takes a certain amount of time. The acts that you do that reduce the amount of suspicion or kind of cool the trail that you've got on you, they take up time. And Zinforth, I think, is like the name of the evil, like, guy. Like, he wants stuff in a specific time. So, yeah, it starts out where, like, you might look at someone's calendar and like you're looking at them a Monday and you're like, right, between midnight and 6 a.m. they're doing one thing, and you're like, well, that's probably sleeping. And so you might spy on them,
okay,
find out that they're sleeping, and assuming they have a regular sleeping pattern, it will fill that out for the rest of the days. So you then have to find out as much as you can about these people, sometimes to then complete another puzzle layer on top of that. Like the example I gave is, there's one that I've done where you're trying to find out about three people at the same time, and your job is to abduct the one that is a loner. So you'll find out, like, if they do things alone or if they do things armed or unarmed. What that process is you find out enough about someone and abducting the right target or targets in a certain amount of time. And assuming you that do that correctly, you then go on to another mini puzzle, which is the essentially the ritual sacrifice part of things, where you all their internal organs are played out, splayed out in front of you. And there are a number of set rules that you need to abide by to please your master. So it's like, if they have kids, break ribs 1, 3, and 17. If they have black hair, remove the left lung.
Weird Christmas games with the family.
It's like a mixture of like Operation, but also it's like a memory test. And did you learn enough about them or remember enough about them to... Right. Please, and then once you do that, then you successfully sacrifice them, and then you get these interstitial, like I said earlier, these visual novel bits, which are basically just like stills with voice acting over the top, that kind of flesh out the game story. Most of the story, and this isn't a spoiler because it happens almost immediately, most of the story revolves around the protagonist, the guy you're playing as, abducting someone who is a witness to his process, but not wanting to kill him because he wasn't one of the select, and so basically keeping him in a cage in his basement and having this like horrible dilemma of like, I believe what I'm doing for a good reason. I believe that I'm saving the world by abducting and killing these people, but I've got this guy that I'm having to keep alive in my basement who's like judging me and like doesn't understand what I'm doing and thinks I'm crazy. It's very interesting. It's just one of those games that like is from a relatively small but prolific developer who have clearly said like, we're not going to go out and make incredibly long or incredibly complicated games. And it is one of those games that you play and you're like, okay, this hasn't had a huge amount of attention to detail put into it. Like, you know, that some corners have been cut in terms of the presentation, and it occasionally feels a little bit kind of like slight and simple. But it's an interesting idea. And I think that's kind of what I wanted to get behind. And a support is a weird word to use when you're buying a video game, but you know what I mean.
No, I know exactly what you mean. I think as well as it's gaming, the beauty of gaming is one of those things where there's space for everything, right? There's space for every genre, every type of game.
Absolutely.
From the indie to the quadruple A.
If the history of film and the history of cinema can be filled with like Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal Lecter and like Kevin Spacey in Seven and stuff like that, like all these really like sick, like fucked up characters, like, and that are almost celebrated in a weird way. I know we have to be careful with that in video games because of interactivity, but it is interesting to be like, talk to someone and be like, yeah, I've been playing a horror kidnapping simulator. You play as a dude who abducts and murders people, and they go, oh my god. But it's like, no, that I think there is an interesting way to have a reasonable and interesting and like not childish or I think there's a way to have a conversation about that kind of game and games that exist within that genre without getting into kind of the hatred territory where it's doing it for attention or for whatever reason.
I think you'd say that to the person like at work, or not anymore, but over the water cooler back in the day, and you'd be like, I'm playing this game, and they'd be like, oh, you're sick, and you're like, isn't your favourite show Dexter? And they'll be like, yeah, what of it?
Right, like, exactly, yeah.
Well, hey, there you go, Life Eater. I'll have to have a look and check that out. Sounds interesting, sounds intriguing.
Yeah, I think it's only Steam at the moment, and it's $15 or $12.79 here in the UK.
Cool. Well, I'm going to talk very briefly about something I haven't played, which is Fallout 4. If you tuned in last week, you would have heard our conversation about the Fallout Prime series and the fact that Fallout is having a boom time because people want more Fallout content off the back of that series. Fallout 4 is doing very well. Fallout 76 has absolutely smashed it. I believe it had 1 million downloads in one day or so last week. But I was one of the people that decided I would reinstall Fallout 4 because it as of recording, so today's the 24th as we record this, as we're live, on the 25th, there's going to be the PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X and S update. And so I thought, what a fantastic time to reinstall and play Fallout 4. But as I do, I messed up a little bit because, of course, I thought, do you know what? It's a few days until it comes out. I can't wait that long. Let me hop in early and have a little play. So I tried to, and I could not, because every time I try and launch Fallout 4 on my PlayStation 5, it crashes. And so I took to the interwebs to find out what the hell was going on. And it turns out that if you are like me and got itchy fingers and immediately downloaded the DLC that was available for Fallout 4, you would realize that on the PlayStation 5, at least, there are two pieces of DLC that will completely brick your game. The Wastelander Workshop and the Automatron DLC packs, which are on sale at the moment, which is the reason why I bought them, downloaded them. I believe they are no longer on sale as of today on PlayStation Store. I might be wrong about that. I think they were reduced like a £10 for all the DLC, which has been released for Fallout 4. So I quickly hopped onto that. Thought, hey, that sounds great. I'm going to start my 60 frames a second Fallout 4 experience in style with all the downloadable DLC. But yeah, as I said, those brick the game and you can't play. And annoyingly, on the PlayStation 5, with PlayStation 4 games, you can't individually uninstall DLCs from games. So the only way you can do it, I understand, is to delete the entire game and start again. So,
why didn't you just do that?
I just couldn't be bothered. Because it was like 2 days before the PlayStation 5 version comes out, and apparently this is going to be fixed with the rollout of the PlayStation 5 updated version. At the very least, you'll be able to actually take off the DLCs individually. So I thought I shouldn't really start playing it until the new version's released. So I thought, hey, let's take a breather. Don't uninstall anything like I would have done 15 times with Life is Strange by now, and we'll just wait and see what happens. So yeah.
To be fair though, when you kind of hinted at what that story might entail to me prior to the podcast, I was getting ready to kind of go all Life is Strange on you. But if the facts to that story are as presented, that is mental. I'm not going to say that's illegal. I'm not going to go for Karen, but like, yeah, that's...
Should we go protest outside Sony?
Yeah, it sounds like it's more of a Bethesda problem. Maybe it shouldn't be too surprising.
Yeah.
At least, you know, a patch that will fix the problem, or hopefully fix the problem, isn't too far away. And technically, Bethesda have also saved you from yourself, and now you don't have to play for 30 frames a second.
All I wanted to do was like maybe create the character and like be in the vault like for 10 minutes. I didn't want to, you know, start playing it properly. So you're right. Maybe they have saved me from myself. But I'll tell you what, I will update you next week as to the state of play and whether or not it all came good in the end.
And also, I'm curious to know how your return to Fallout 4 kind of panned out in terms of how much of it stuck with you and your desire to kind of keep going. I played a little bit of Fallout 4 in the past week, PC version, so I didn't have any of the same issues you did, fortunately. And I was like, yeah, that was fun. And then I haven't played it again since that night.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, no, I hope I don't have the same thing. I kind of think I might, but I don't know. We'll find out. But anyway, from DLC that was downloadable but you couldn't play, if you're me, to DLC that was just never, ever made. This is a story coming in from a GTA 5 actor who claimed that he shot some stuff, that was his quote, for DLC starring his character Trevor, but that it was cancelled and that's why it never saw the light of day. This is the Trevor, Stephen Ogg, who played Trevor, and the DLC that was apparently named Agent Trevor and was sort of James Bond-esque, and was one of three cancelled expansions for the game alongside Zombie Apocalypse and Alien Invasion, which never saw the light of day. I believe that they were sort of co-opted and then they were rolled into the online GTA Online, right, which is how this stuff was actually discovered. Because people did some cheeky data mining.
That's right, yeah. The data mining, I think, revealed the names of the expansions, and I think it was also data mining that was able to link some content that would later appear in some of GTA Online's updates with content that might have been planned for or adapted from these, you know, these originally what might have been a single player piece of DLC. But this is the first time beyond data mining that we've got any real kind of inclination that something like this existed or how far along it might have been beyond references in file names and so on.
My first question to you, knowing what a massive GTA and specifically GTA 5 fan you were slash are, and I know how much you're looking forward to GTA 6, how do you feel about the fact, as someone who'd never really got on with GTA Online, you know, that much, but that there was some cancelled, three, in fact, cancelled DLCs. How does that sort of strike you?
It strikes me as a little bit sad, but not all that disappointing. You know, it's interesting. I was looking at some conversation around this story on Reddit, and I think there are some people for whom the idea of cancelled or non-existent single-player DLC is still very much an open wound. For me, it's a closed wound. That game is 11 years old at this point, and while there would have been, you know, a point in my life where I would have been, even up till now, even, you know, that I would have been extremely interested in some more content for GTA 5 in the same way I'd be interested for just about any content that, you know, Rockstar would be willing to put their name on it. But it wasn't to be. It's one of those things that, as we've discussed many, many times on podcasts, you know, lately, and of course going back months and years at this point, that sometimes getting a little bit too upset over cancelled content while not knowing why it was cancelled, or, you know, how justified that cancellation was, can be a little bit of a slippery slope. You know, we don't know how early these things were. We don't know how, you know, how ambitious they were, how big they were going to be. You know, for all we know, that, you know, Agent Trevor, it could have been an 8-hour long story expansion that could have been, you know, really cool and shown us a whole new side to one of, you know, GTA fans' favorite characters. Or it could have been, you know, a glorified like skin pack with some new outfits and some new weapons that had a cutscene at the beginning, and that's what Stephen Ogg shot. You know, and that's maybe a little bit harsh in terms of, you know, how slight this DLC could have been. But the point I'm making is that we just don't know. And so I usually use that as a reason to not let myself get too disappointed about what could have been, because it just, there's you have to entertain a pretty large and unquantifiable hypothetical to kind of get into that territory of, you know, life-changing DLC for GTA 5 that we never got. And I think the other element, sorry.
I was going to say, isn't it, because on my brain, any time I hear something like this, it goes to, this was going to be the best possible thing they ever could have released. It would have been better than the main game. But any time I hear DLCs cancelled or this was the idea, you're absolutely right. Like, it could have been, it could have been some test shootings they did with the actor to kind of get a feel for whether they thought it was going to be all right. And then they went, you know what? This doesn't sort of work for us. Whereas in my brain, it's like, no. This was going to be award worthy. This is going to be fantastic DLC.
Well, the thing that you have going for you in that argument, at least, is track record. Like, it would be very unlike a Rockstar to release something bad. So, like, you do have that, like, you know, carrying some favor for, you know, the version of this that existed in your head. But I don't know. Like, the other thing we know about Rockstar, and this actually ties into the point I was just making about their kind of their benchmark for quality and the levels they set for themselves, is that they do have extremely high aspirations for when it comes to the kind of the quality of the material they produce. We know, you know, from some kind of inside sources and reports around the time, that Red Dead Redemption 2's development was extremely difficult because of just how high a, you know, how high a bar they set for themselves, and that there was lots of work that was done and then ripped up and restarted and done and ripped up and restarted, and that blueprint for what Red Dead Redemption 2 ended up being was completely reset multiple times. You know, it would not be remotely surprising to me if there was also some of that at play in the GTA kind of DLC story. But again, all of this relies on kind of speculation that we just don't know and probably never will, because we're talking about one of the most secretive game developers in the entirety of the industry. One thing I will say, though, and this maybe is going to be a little bit controversial, but I'll say it anyway, I think the idea of an Agent Trevor DLC, whatever that would have entailed, sounds quite interesting. I think Trevor was one of the more interesting characters in that game, and I liked Stephen Ogg's performance very much. The idea of the zombie apocalypse and an alien invasion single-player DLC significantly less interesting to me. Now,
yep.
Some people will immediately point to Undead Nightmare and say, look how seamlessly they crossed over, you know, the Old West with zombies and made a really meaningful piece of DLC. But even the idea of an Undead Nightmare style expansion for GTA 5 that contained either zombies or aliens, for some reason, just doesn't tickle me in the same way that Undead Nightmare was able to. I don't know why. But
no, I think
I was more interested in, you know, sort of story driven and relatively speaking grounded content. If GTA 5's world were to have been explored more than aliens and zombies.
I think you're bang on. Like, if you think about the stuff they did do that had tied into the alien stuff for GTA 5, like, it was side content that was a bit, you know, it was okay, but you wasn't that interesting.
Yeah, there were hallucinations and weird shit like that. Like, it wasn't... Yeah.
Exactly. And when it comes to the alien side of it, like, GTA 5 is not the best game for, shooting mechanics, for example. And a lot, if you're trying to sort of pick off headshots and stuff of zombies, that doesn't sound that exciting. And when you suddenly pair back that world from sort of like the hustle and the bustle to mindless drones following you around some streets in GTA, that doesn't actually sound that interesting to me. I think I'm totally right with you. Whereas when you say Trevor was going to be, as they've said, it was potentially going to be, he was an undercover agent working with working for the feds, and how, you know, he was just trying to do his best, which is what they've said, but he's still kind of a fuck up. I think that sounds GTA to me. That sounds like,
yeah,
you can imagine Trevor in those scenes. You can imagine the cutscenes. You can imagine the things that could go wrong and the way that mission formats would come out of that, much more so than you can with alien invasion and a zombie sort of apocalypse sort of situations. But then, you know, as you said, we don't know where we were at with these DLCs. We don't know whether they were just starting out with them, and there must have been a reason they decided not to do them. So,
yeah, and like, sometimes the filming for these things, or filming the performance capture, can happen extremely early in the process, and not be representative of what the finished products are going to look like. And the other thing that I wanted to quickly say when it comes to GTA 5, inevitably, whenever there's a conversation about cancelled single-player content, expansions, DLC, or anything like that, someone, you know, mentions the elephant in the room, which is GTA Online, and the extent to which Rockstar were distracted, I guess, by the popularity of that mode and the amount of revenue it was able to generate for them. And especially, I think, when you've got evidence that some of the single-player content was reworked or adapted for GTA Online content, it kind of backs up some of those theories. But I personally don't give them too much of a hard time for that. I think, like, that
that's part of the course in video game, yeah, production, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And again, like, I know some people are disappointed with GTA Online and kind of like where it went, and a lot of people fell off over the years, but they did deliver some occasionally very big expansions to that, and characters like Franklin, for example, did return, and we did get some payoffs, and, you know, we did get, you know, things that made good on the groundwork laid out by GTA 5, just in a format that, you know, whilst it wasn't appealing to you or I, or I'm sure many of the people watching or listening, was clearly, you know, relevant to, you know, the massive amounts of people who play that game mode. And, you know, we can't sit here sort of like begrudging an industry slump and redundancies and layoffs and cancelled projects on one hand, and criticize a game company for making money on the other. Like, you know, at some point, you know, you have executives, you have suits, you have pressure from higher ups, and when one graph is going one way and another graph is going another way, you know, you often out of your hands. And if that put food on tables of Rockstar employees, then I don't really give a shit.
No, that's fair. But but yeah. Oh well, hey, we can wait for GTA 6 and then we can see, we can all get our we can all eat the day that GTA 6 comes out, and we can have a lot more GTA 5.
Indeed. Hell yeah.
From that single player perspective. But from a performance of Stephen Oggs that unfortunately we won't get to see, that DLC content, to a performance we will get to see, because we have had it confirmed that Keanu Reeves is going to be playing the role of Shadow in Sonic the Hedgehog 3, the movie, which comes out next year, I believe. This comes from The Hollywood Reporter. This follows news that Paramount's debut showing of the Sonic the 3 footage during CinemaCon last week, which reportedly included the revelation that Dr. Robotnik, played by Jim Carrey, was depressed and out of shape after the events of Sonic 2. If anyone remembers that, he basically gets superpowered in Sonic 2 and with an emerald, Chaos Emerald, and then gets all of that power sucked out of him. And I'm going to say, surprisingly, doesn't die. I thought he was... It was obvious, I suppose, that he was going to come back, but I'm pretty sure he was dead. So it's one of those. But then we also got the tease at the end of that one that Shadow was going to be in the next movie. We got a little post-credit scene. Yeah, so good to hear that Keanu Reeves is going to be picking up the role of voicing Shadow, who's going to help Robotnik get his groove back. My kids are going to be absolutely ecstatic to see that.
Yes. Film. And that actually comes out this year. That's a December 20th.
Sorry, yes, this
release
year.
Date.
Blimey.
At the moment. That's which not reminds long. Me, no, and I still haven't seen the second one yet. I still don't even know if Knuckles.
Oh, and I'm ruining it for you, and you've not even seen it.
Ruining in inverted commas when it comes to the Sonic films. Like, I thought the first one was fine. But I'm actually, like, more excited about this direction than I thought I would be. I don't know what I'm more excited about. Shadow being introduced and being voiced by Keanu Reeves, or Jim Carrey playing fat Dr. Robotnik.
It's funny because
egg-shaped Robotnik, like.
Yeah, because they started off where he looked completely wrong and different. Then in the second one, he was bald with the wide mustache, and so now that he's going to be the fat, bald, wide mustached Robotnik that we all love, I think that's I like that progression. I think that's pretty cool that they've done.
Yes, that's cool. Yeah,
because I
also like that Jim Carrey, like in this weird stage of this career that he's at, where he still just for whatever reason just really likes doing these Sonic films. Either that or the check is massive. Probably
he's good. He's really good in them. Like I can see why they're like, you know, if people want to criticize them and say, you know, they're this, they're that. I love, my kids absolutely love them, and I love watching them with them. We've watched each of them like about five times now. So many times. And there's a lot of fun to be had. And yeah, Jim Carrey's really good. Idris Elba as Knuckles is really good. I can never remember the guy's name.
He's now got his own show, Knuckles, right?
I think. Oh, it's out. I totally forget. Yeah, it comes out this month.
I think I read some reviews for that it's today. Out.
I think it might be out on the 30th. Let me just look it up while we're talking. So it's,
that really your kids will not let you live that down if you don't keep track of when that's coming out.
So my eldest asked me the other day, which is why I know it's coming out very soon. I think it's a 5-series limited run. Let me just look it up.
Pulse TV series. It's
26th of April, 2 days, Friday in the US.
Apparently, it sounds like they're going to drop all 6 episodes at once, potentially, which is nice.
Yeah, but that's that's cool. That's good.
How do you feel about Keanu? Obviously, like a very fan favorite casting, and you know, one of the internet's kind of like favorite children, but someone who has maybe received some criticism in the past for what have been like relatively flat or unusual performances. It does seem like he's a little bit kind of. Like, you don't know what you're going to get with Keanu. Like, as someone who has a little more of a knowledge of than I do of what to expect from Sonic films in terms of, you know, the comedy and the delivery and things like that. How do you feel about it all?
When I initially found out about it from you, actually, via WhatsApp, yeah. I was a little bit hesitant because I think the energy might be lacking. But then at the same time, like, I didn't think Knuckles would have been well served being voiced by Idris Elba, and I think he did a great job, and I think it worked totally for the character. Shadow is supposed to be like this, you know, darker, more brooding character than Sonic. He's got almost like Sonic's alter ego, like it's like Sonic and Shadow, right? So I actually think that it could work really well. And when you consider the fact that we did get a very good performance, I think, as Johnny Silverhand from Keanu Reeves in Cyberpunk 2077, I'm a lot more positive than maybe I would have been before having played Cyberpunk. So no, I'm looking forward to it. I think it's a cool casting. Anything with Keanu in is cool. It's like you said, you don't know if you're going to get gold standard Keanu or like occasionally phones it in a little bit Keanu because he's just Keanu. He can do what he wants. We'll see.
Yeah. I feel like his reputation for phoning it in has kind of improved a little bit. And there have been,
yeah, agree.
In the last 10 years, there have been more and more performances that appear to be indicative of a Keanu who kind of knows what his reputation is and is able to kind of tap into what he's being asked to do rather than, like, you know, just reading the script and being himself. Like, there's evidence that he's a little bit more in on the joke than he might have been at times. Right. Do you know which one? I'm sure you'd have seen it because of the kids, but which voice performance actually, like, won me over in terms of I think he gets it, was actually when he plays the stuntman or the stunt driver in Toy Story 4, the Evel Knievel style guy.
Not seen it.
Not seen Toy Story 4.
Not seen Toy Story 4. I'm not a big Toy Story family.
Fair enough. Toy Story 4 is a good Toy Story as it goes. They went from not needing to make another one to actually making a pretty darn good one, I thought. But he plays, I can't remember the character's name for the life of me, but he plays kind of a sort of almost like an anxiety-riddled version of Evel Knievel, obviously in toy form.
Right.
Kind of want to be one of these toys that, like, you would drop and they would go and do a loop-to-loop and fly off.
He's one
of those.
Okay.
And kind of it's that weird sort of like blend of kind of some of that Johnny Silverhand-esque machoism kind of, but with a sort of a sensitive side. And I thought he pulled it off quite nicely. Fingers crossed that all works out well for Sonic.
Nice. Yeah. Looking forward to it. Do you know someone who never phones it in, Jamie?
You?
Not just me. I do sometimes. No, it's Rodrigo. In the chat with his $5 super chat, never phoning it in, there to deliver. He says, "Dang, can't watch you guys live. We'll catch the VOD later. Have a good pod, guys. Thank you so much for the super chat. Very much appreciated, Rodrigo. Enjoy catching up on the VOD, or on podcasting platforms if you'd rather watch it there, or maybe even in a bite sized snapshot version of the show."
Yes, everyone needs to know that Jonesy has started taking clips from these podcasts and uploading them to the YouTube channel. So if you're ever sitting at home, maybe you're bored, maybe you're on your lunch break and you think, I need something between 10 minutes and 30 minutes to fill this little gap I've got in my life, and you want to see us go through, you know, some conversations and chats and debates that we've had in the podcast of the past, then keep an eye out for Jonesy's expertly made new clips.
There you go. Yeah, I'm one of the reasons I like to do it is because when we're talking, so for example, you were talking about Life Eater, and I'm like, do you know what? I want to see some footage of that game when I'm hearing Jamie talk about it and describe it. So maybe this week you'll be lucky and there'll be a little Life Eater clip there with some game footage for you to check out as well.
There you go. That's a good idea.
Yeah, well, you see, so always thinking, mate, always thinking. But from Sonic, we have to move on to Ubisoft, because we have had leaks that include an image of, I never know how to say his name, Cillian Murphy, I'm going with, or Cillian. Is it Cillian or Cillian? I think it's Cillian.
I think you're right. I think it's a hard C.
Hard. He's a hard C. No, I'm joking. Cillian Murphy in a tease about Far Cry 7. Far Cry, I think, has become synonymous with epic villains, and I think Cillian Murphy is one hell of an actor. You know, to be tying to that series, yes, to that franchise. When you told me about this the other day, I did get a little bit excited. So
I only told you because I got excited. I think I messaged you and Chris at like 12:30 in the morning when this tweet that you're kind of we're about to talk about was first posted, and everyone was getting really excited and kind of like maybe letting their imaginations run away from them a little bit. Because the idea of Cillian Murphy, who was already a cool actor, but that was, you know, maybe this time a year ago or 2 years ago, you'd have said, yeah, he's a cool actor, good actor. He has since then gone on to become, you know, one of the most talked about actors of the last year, largely obviously because of his central performance, his titular performance in Oppenheimer, which also won him an Oscar. But then it was that combined with the fact that you watched him on sort of press junkets and interviews for Oppenheimer. And this was a guy who, like, he didn't know what memes were and didn't engage with the conversation about using emojis and things like that. And I was like, the idea of that guy agreeing to do a video game, for as much as like Giancarlo Esposito was a big get for 6, and I could see them trying to up the ante, it did seem a little bit odd, even at first.
I don't think it's that odd these days, because what I imagine happens, and I think the Game Awards play this out when we get to a little cameo from an actor. I think that their agent calls them up and says, "Hey man, I've got a project for you, Far Cry 7. They're going to pay you $150 million. You in?" And then Killian's like, "Yeah, I'm in." And then he rocks up to work, yeah. And then it's mocap, and it's everything's going to be. And they're like, "Hold on, what is this?" And it's like, "Oh, it's a video game." So in my mind, that's what happens these days, and necessarily it doesn't mean they need to be a video game enthusiast.
But one, like, do we, like, is that one? I don't think that kind of money is actually up for grabs.
I don't know how much.
Like, can we, any of us, like, remember the last time an actor gave themselves over to the video game industry at the peak of their career? Not in the money grubbing or I'm on the back end of my career kind of trajectory.
Were we going to say Kevin Spacey was on the back end of his career for COD?
No, you're right. Kevin Spacey, because obviously this was pre-cancellation Kevin Spacey. I'd say that's a great shout for one of the bigger ones.
I'm trying to think who else would kind of...
Kit Harington from Game of Thrones. He was another Call of Duty villain. Keanu, we talked about. Norman Reedus.
Who was the fella from Avantium, the new game, the young lad who's been in a few...
Avantium?
What's the game called that's on? It was on PlayStation Plus last month.
Immortals of Avium.
Avium? What's Avantium? What am I thinking of? Yeah, there was the lad who's a sort of up-and-coming actor who's been in a few things on that.
I don't know.
I
don't think he's a big deal yet.
No,
and also, right. Immortals of Avium came out before Roadhouse.
Oh, okay. So he's even less of a big deal. And actually thinking about it, I think he had one line in Roadhouse, so maybe he's not that much of a big actor anymore.
Yeah. But again, you're looking through it, like Martin Sheen was the elusive man in the Mass Effect series. Kristen Bell was in Assassin's Creed. Sean Bean in The Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion. Obviously, Beyond Two Souls got Willem Dafoe and Elliot Page.
It's not massive, is it?
Kiefer Sutherland playing a Snake in Metal Gear Solid 5. Fallout 3 got Liam Neeson to play your dad. That was pretty cool. Gary Oldman played that bad guy in Call of Duty Black Ops. There are some good ones, but like...
I tell you, mate, it's all about... oh god, I can't remember the name of it. It's been that long. Cloud Imperium Games, Star Citizen.
Oh, to be fair, Star Citizen's actor cast in the world is balls out crazy. Like that's for,
but it's not
actually.
Out.
And I've just been reminded of another one that had like a great cast that was let down by how fucking weird that game was, and I don't know how many people even knew that the cast was in it. But 12 Minutes was James McAvoy, yes. Daisy Ridley, and Willem Dafoe.
There also, what was the game that we talked about earlier in the year, which was obviously just like they're going to put every old school action actor into it.
Oh, you're thinking of Crime Boss Rocket City, maybe?
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
That's and then of course, Alone in the Dark just came out. That was Jodie Comer and David Harbour. Quantum Break, were that like that had a lot. There was a lot of like, hey, do you remember me? I was in The Wire. Or hey, do you remember me? I was in Game of Thrones. Kind of actors.
Yep.
But they were still like fairly big deals. I don't know. Basically, there have been some. I guess the point I was trying to make was how many people walk off the stage at the Academy Awards and into the into a latex suit?
Not many.
Not many.
But hey, let me give you let me clarify the situation with this, because we might be jumping the gun a little bit by suggesting that Cillian Murphy is actually going to be in Far Cry 7.
Very good point.
So a known insider, Jonathan, with a zero, I'm guessing that's not a typo from Jamie's part.
No, it's not.
Who has a pretty good record with leaks, kind of got the internet talking last week, this whole Cillian Murphy thing, with a bit of a cryptic tweet, because it showed four images featuring a picture of Cillian Murphy, a bomb with a 72-hour timer, a large crab, and the number 7 in a Far Cry-ish font. So I don't think it's too much for people to put those things together and think that that is suggesting that Cillian Murphy was going to be the new antagonist in Far Cry 7. And a number of outlets did actually come out and they sort of looked at the tweet and they said, hey, this is probably what this means. Subsequently, though, Jonathan has later come out and said he never said Cillian Murphy was going to be in the game, but it could mean that a new entry in this series has progressed enough that we could well be hearing about it in the summer forward this year, which is kind of like a bit skeezy to sort of, because you know we're going to think that, but at the same time, you know, yeah. I get it. Maybe it's because of, you know, maybe he's trying to say the energy of Cillian Murphy is going to be in Far Cry 7. You don't know.
I think no matter how, you know, charitable a version of it we get, I think it ends up being cheeky. It sets people off down a different path, which a lot of them are just a lot less exciting. Like, is it an indirect Oppenheimer reference? Is that an indirect nuclear bomb sort of reference, or kind of like apocalyptic nuclear threat reference? One thing people did point to was the fact that so the bomb with the 72-hour timer appears to be a reference to, there was a report that Tom Henderson and Insider Gaming put together, I think it was a while ago, sometime last year, that Far Cry 7, at least in what at that time, still in a fairly early stage, and I think we talked about in this podcast, was flirting with the idea of having this non-linear kind of progression system where you played as a character whose family had been kidnapped and you had 72 in-game hours to save their lives, which would translate to 24 real-world hours. So that was in a report from Insider Gaming that Jonathan is either corroborating with this tweet or just leaning into to create more Far Cry 7 speculation. It's very hard to know, but Jonathan is almost exclusively like Ubisoft related, and he's a guy who, he clearly knows someone who knows someone, or
who heard a thing. Like he knows what's going on to some degree.
But he doesn't stray outside of like Ubisoft really, and Jonathan's been on the scene for a couple of years now. But the problem is he's having fun with this, and as we've talked about before, where, you know, we've talked about like Jeff Grubb and Tom Henderson and the role of insiders in today's industry, and Tom Henderson, for example, going on record saying the reason he refuses to do a podcast is because you can't have fun with the things you do and or don't know, because all the internet wants right now are headlines and tweets.
Right.
And as soon as you're one or two people removed from your quote, it's become a news story. And that's exactly what happened here. Like Eurogamer, I should try and find Eurogamer's original headline for this, because like I saw that, and that's almost more what made me message you guys than the tweet itself. I think they've changed the headline now, but
it's very
It
is that thing of what do the Americans call it, like the game of telephone, where these days where there's a tweet which then becomes a headline, which then becomes an article, and it doesn't take many sort of leaps before it's completely bent out of shape and actually you're taking a whole bunch of stuff from it that someone never said. Very, very, very true. Any luck on the old?
No, I found the article. I think the headlines changed. I mean, the first
maybe they changed it because they were like, this is not what it said.
Well, they have updated the article, but the original story, the first line of the original story was, Oppenheimer star Cillian Murphy may play the villain in Far Cry 7.
Right.
And again, you look at the tweet that they're basing it off. It's a guy called Jonathan who tweets in French, if nothing changes by then, with an emoji face. And it's just a picture of Cillian Murphy at the red carpet. With the aforementioned other images. Like, they haven't even bothered trying to deduce what the giant crab is referring to.
Isn't the crab from Far Cry 3? Isn't there a giant crab?
Yeah, but this is a crab on the poster. This is a giant crab. This is like a crab that's like 10 times the height of a man.
Oh,
this isn't like an Elder Scrolls Oblivion crab. This is like a giant crab.
Mm. Just super cryptic. Interesting.
Super cryptic and you know, so a guy being trying to be funny and maybe slightly clout chasey with information that he maybe has, maybe doesn't have, and outlets do what they do with these pieces of information nowadays. It's just the way that the world works.
Yes, absolutely. But moving on from Far Cry, we do have a little bit more news coming from Ubisoft. This is, as you said, Tom Henderson is a great source of information. Tom Henderson has always been talking about Assassin's Creed, and we haven't decided how to say this. I want to say Hex. Jamie's going Hexe, so let's go Hex for now, because I can't bother to say Hexe. But we probably won't be seeing any more of it until next year's Forward, unfortunately. But what we do know at the moment is that Hex is going to lean heavily into witchcraft. The game is rumored to be set in Central Europe during the 16th century, with the Holy Roman Empire. And the game is in a relatively early stage of development. It's expected to be released in 2026 on the Infinity platform. It's also understood to be a bit more linear in experience compared to some of the predecessors, in the Assassin's Creed series, with elements of open world exploration. Hex is also poised to have a single female protagonist, currently named Elsa, who will have some supernatural abilities, and is possible that she's going to be hunted by 16th century German soldiers, and that she has to use spells to possess things, and she can possess a cat, so you could be knocking around as a cat in the Animus this time and not just an eagle or a human. That'll be exciting. So a bit of Stray sliding into into the Assassin's Creed world.
I don't mind. I will say, like, for what it's worth, you know, kind of not focusing on the nature of the content, we're just talking about the leaks, that this is the kind of thing I way more prefer to what Jonathan did. Like, this is when someone has some kind of inside information. It's like, I'm going to get all the information I can, I'm going to corroborate it, and then I'm going to write a report, and it's going to have, and I'm not going to tease anyone, and I'm not going to hint at anything, and I'm not going to play the I know things that you don't know game that people love playing. So I guess shout out to Tom Henderson on that front. And yeah, it sounds interesting. I'll be honest, obviously it could be very early. In fact, it is very early. We know that much. It's at least 2 years early, if not more. But the idea of an Assassin's Creed game where one possesses a cat and knocks over a glass bottle to distract a 16th century German soldier, it doesn't scream Assassin's Creed off the rip. But at the same token, like, I don't mind with them experimenting with the Assassin's Creed formula. I don't mind them trying to do different things within that kind of playground. I guess largely for two reasons. One, because I think with Hexe in particular, it's I believe, unless anything has changed behind the scenes, it's still being helmed by Clint Hocking, who I think is one of the more interesting kind of like creatives in the Ubisoft kind of sphere. Obviously, his work on Far Cry 2 was argued by some to be ahead of its time. And then when he returned to Ubisoft on Watch Dogs Legion, in spite of some of that game's failures, that Watch Dogs Legion still had some incredibly interesting and some interesting ideas that were actually, you know, pulled off incredibly well, and I think overlooked by a lot of people because of somewhat generic gameplay in other areas. So I think his, you know, sort of attachment to the project is a positive thing. But the overwhelming point is that something that you mentioned, Jonesy, that this is obviously rumored to be released on the Infinity platform, which you have to imagine after a certain time, once the Infinity platform has been established, everything Assassin's Creed will be. But I think if they're going to do this thing where there's this ongoing Assassin's Creed universe, this live service-y Assassin's Creed element where there's this launcher that houses all these games, then there are going to be big games and there are going to be small games and these 150-hour long RPGs and then these kind of spin-off things. If they're going to go down that road and put all their eggs in the Assassin's Creed basket, then at the very least, they have to make different kinds of Assassin's Creed games, in like games that kind of spin the formula a little bit, that turn things on their head, that like give us a different look, not just a different period of history and a different, like, you know, types of protagonists and different means of like melee combat, but like actually looking at the fundamentals of kind of like the, you know, the game design, right. Or like what the impetus behind the game is. Like, they need as much variety as possible if they're going to continue to go down this road where, like, again, if other reports from this week are to be believed, Watch Dogs, for example, is essentially dead internally at Ubisoft. If they're going to keep going that road when more and more franchises fall by the wayside and Assassin's Creed becomes this, you know, hub with thousands of people around the world working on it and new experiences being dropped on Assassin's Creed Infinity every year, they need things like this. As weird as the cat shit sounds.
Plot twist that Assassin's Creed and Ubisoft effectively are just, this has all been getting us to the point where they release the Animus for real, and they are the Illuminati.
They're Abstergo.
They're Abstergo. And this is all been smoke and mirrors, red hair.
I mean, they have alluded to that themselves at points, haven't they? Where, like, isn't it Assassin's Creed Black Flag, where you're basically going with the first person outside of the Animus Sapiens, where you're going to work for, like,
a
video game developer to create, like, gamified versions of Animus memories. But,
and then they make the console, don't they? And then they end with the...
Yeah, so they got some weird directions. I wouldn't mind if they walked some of that stuff back, but I don't think they're going to, especially not if, like, Mirage wasn't too bad, but, like, Valhalla had some really fucked up shit when it comes to, like, animacy elements towards the end of it. I still implore anyone who doesn't know how Assassin's Creed Valhalla ends to just go out and watch YouTube videos on it, because it is hilarious and fascinating in equal measure. But I don't know. I just hope they keep things interesting. There are rumors out there that they're remaking Black Flag. Like, again, if that's cadence. But yeah, I agree. And if that's the cadence of Infinity, that, like, we get Assassin's Creed Red, which is this 150-hour, you know, Odyssey, Valhalla-style action RPG set in feudal Japan, and then Hexei is like a 30-hour kind of slightly more linear, you know, it, like, 16th century Holy Roman Empire kind of thing, and then you get a Black Flag remake, and you just keep, like, finding ways to kind of keep people on their toes, then I don't mind that.
Yeah,
that's more interesting to me than just a 150-hour RPG every 2 years.
I think if that's the case, like, it doesn't justify the whole Infinity project. If you're just releasing games, you don't need a platform that's going to house all this stuff. If that was the case, if it's every 2 years,
Do you know what else I'd love as well? Just because it's somewhat, we talked last week about the Rogue Prince of Persia, and how there was a story that the way that the Rogue Prince of Persia came about was that, was it Evil Empire or whatever they're called, the people who worked on Dead Cells after the fact, approached Ubisoft and were like, can we make a Prince of Persia game? And Ubisoft were like, yes. Like, that is exactly the kind of thing that Assassin's Creed Infinity would be cool for. If we started to get, you know, take the Rogue Prince of Persia and make the Assassin's Creed, like, I'm not talking about a 2D roguelike game with a, you know, a flat kind of, like, borderline cel-shaded arts. I'm not meaning the specifics of that. I mean, conceptually, letting other developers put completely different genres or twists and spins on what it means to be an Assassin's Creed game. I think that's how you justify Infinity's existence.
I completely agree. Like, that to me makes so much more sense. If you have lots of different companies and developers feeding into that one ecosystem and giving you, and that's just the house for everything. Like you said, if it's one action RPG, like, every 2 years, I can't really see the point.
Right, exactly.
I kind of can't see the point anyway, but it remains to be seen. I hope it's really cool and it works really well, and everyone's like, "Oh, this is so great that they did this." Like, well, I want companies to do new stuff and try new things, but we often hear about games that are going to be presented in this way, and then it doesn't quite come off. I mean, maybe it's a bit unfair, but was the Ubisoft extreme sports game that they made?
Riders Republic,
like, that kind of had a similar setup where they were like, hey, you're going to be able to do all these different extreme sports, but it's going to be like a hub world where you jump in and then you go and do this, and it was a great idea. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a fantastic game. Problem is, no one played it, and then it didn't do much
for that. Is true that Riders Republic needed more. Riders Republic was an underplayed game. I think they even might have got to the point where, like, they had their own skateboarding game in there. But that was like DLC, and so even less than the small amount of players who jumped into Riders Republic got to play it. But I'd be fascinated to know, like, in this kind of post-Tony Hawk, pre-skate revival world we live in, what Riders Republic skateboarding game would have looked like.
Yeah, no, me too. Like, yeah, it's a shame. It's a shame in some respects when games don't really perform as well as they should do. But hey, it remains to be seen. Hopefully we'll get some more leaks from Tom Henderson or from Jonathan in the future, and we know more about what's going on over at Ubisoft.
I think that's a given.
We know more about what's going on over at Embracer, though, because unfortunately, following some hard times, let's be honest, that Embracer have had, you know, a number of studio closures, thousands of job losses, they have announced recently that they are going to be splitting into three distinct companies, and that they're going to be broken up into Middle-earth Enterprises and Friends, Coffee Stain and Friends, and Asmodee Group. To just give you a background of what each one of these separate companies is now going to be responsible for. So Middle Earth Enterprises and Friends is going to encompass Embracer's biggest studios and brands. We're talking Crystal Dynamics, Eidos Montreal, 4A Games, PlayOn, and Deep Silver, Dan Buster Studios, as well as Warhorse. And then you're going to have Coffee Stain and Friends, which is going to include more of your indie outfits. So that's going to include Coffee Stain. It's also going to be Ghost Ship Games, Tarsier, and some free-to-play developers. And then you've got Asmodee, which is going to be the company's tabletop arm, who own Ticket to Ride, Exploding Kittens, Azul, and Catan. I suppose not that surprising that they sort of had to do something, had to move and shake over there at Embracer, because after spending a butt ton of money in the last few years and sort of buying everyone they can get their hands on, I suppose, what do they say? The chickens have come home to roost and they've had to do some stuff on the business end. What are your thoughts on this? I don't know, would you call this like a restructuring? Because it feels like it's not just going to, they're not going to be completely separate, are they? They're still going to be intertwined in some fashion, I would have thought.
Right, yeah, you'd imagine so. I don't want to know why kind of behind the scenes, but like maybe they're just sort of splitting these entities up into sort of these three distinct paths and kind of having a relatively clear outline of, you know, depending on the size or the scale of the project, or whether, of course, in the case of Asmodee, it's like a tabletop thing, which is, you know, completely separate to the video game ventures. Like maybe it does just kind of like simplify things. That honestly, like naming aside, we'll get to that in a second, because I think it's slightly unusual. It just kind of helps clarity. It is one of those things where there have been a lot of chopping and changing in Embracer. They spent so long picking up various companies and acquiring various studios, and now have spent a not insignificant amount of time relinquishing a lot of that. Even up until, you know, in the last month or so, Embracer's Saber assets were sold off, and of course, Gearbox went back to Take-Two. They've got significantly smaller. Embrace Group have. They've recouped a lot of money that clearly they needed, as the sales not just indicated, but also the outrageous number of layoffs that were experienced throughout that company. I suppose when you look at something like this, then what you're hoping for, sort of, I guess, best case scenario, is that this is indicative of them almost getting their ducks in a row, sitting down, looking at what they've got left. We'll see everything has either been, everything that's going to be sold or moved on has been saying, right, here's what we're left with. Here's the three lanes they sit within. Now, how can we focus on making these the best studios they can be and making us the best and most, you know, secure kind of business we can be for the sake of the security of all the various employees whose futures are tied up within this mess. If this is the kind of the beginning of a kind of much more stable and secure future for all the individuals involved, then that would be a great thing. That being said, I do still think the naming element is weird. I know that Lord of the Rings is a massive franchise. I know they spent a lot of money making sure that they were going to be the Lord of the Rings people. But the idea that, even if it just ends up being internally, the idea that legendary developers like Crystal Dynamics are now tied up in some weird thing where they're a part of Middle Earth Enterprises and Friends is just absolutely bizarre to me. And there's something about the Friends element that just doesn't sit right with me. As it might be from an organizational perspective.
No, I'm completely with you, because it actually suggests that, for example, like in the case of Crystal Dynamics, you want to talk about Tomb Raider as being one of the most recognizable worldwide gaming franchises of all time, potentially. And you want to say, but now they are just they're an afterthought to to Lord of the Rings games, which are not.
They haven't even made a Lord of the Rings game yet. They just like spent a load of money to be able to do so in the future, is my understanding of it. And they the idea that the teams that made the recent Tomb Raider games and Guardians of the Galaxy and Metro and Dead Island, and the recently announced Kingdom Come Deliverance 2, has kind of sat there going, we're the Friends. That feels a bit gross to me. And don't get me wrong, if they wanted to go back to your original question, if for whatever reason, for whatever business reason, internally embraced a wish to split all the companies and all the studios they owned into these three distinct entities, and internally they refer to them as Middle-earth Enterprises and Friends, then I guess that's fine. But the idea that any of this is public-facing and has been discussed in the way that we're discussing it now, just weird.
I think the only thing that sort of worries me a little bit as well, and I'm sure there's business reasons for doing it beyond like my comprehension, what worries me a little bit is the exposure and the risk profiles that each of these different companies are going to have. Because if you consider like Middle Earth and Friends, is, as you said, is you know, has a lot of these very big franchises in it, AAA games have made a lot of money over the years, very recognizable. And Embracer have said that this sort of entity is going to be the creative powerhouse in AAA game development and publishing for PC and console. And the stewards for that, like you said, that Lord of the Rings franchise and for Tomb Raider and things like that. I would have liked it maybe if some of those powerhouse titles were more strongly tied to their indie, smaller, you know, not indie, but their pseudo indie out offering, just to kind of give them a bit of backup on the monetary front. Like, if we, the problem that we've always had with like large companies taking over a lot of studios, especially beloved studios, is that when the company gets into trouble, it seems to be quite easy for them to just sell off huge swathes of these things and to slice them up and whatever. But surely in some instances, the benefit is the fact that they've got, in the good times, they've got money to support these companies and do whatever. What I would hate to see is, you know, their small, like Coffee Stain and Friends part, effectively go, actually, do you know what? We're really struggling. And you're like, yeah, but maybe they should have chucked a couple of the AAA developers in there as that part of the company to protect them a little bit.
We'll see. But, yeah, you know, maybe. Because there's definitely going to be discrepancies, you know, on the kind of like on the financials when it could, like, you look at the revenue generated by Coffee Stain and Friends versus Middle Earth Enterprises and Friends. You'd imagine there to be big gulfs in those numbers. I guess maybe that, you know, there's hopefully some room on the Embracer side for those two entities to not be compared directly. You know, for the understanding of kind of like one being a smaller indie label and having a different degree of expectations as a result, being a part of the way the setup works. But we just don't know. I guess that's the, one of the disadvantages of having information like that this made public, but without an awareness of kind of like the wider plans or the futures of any of these stratas.
Yeah. I do have a quote to finish us off on this Embracer story. This is coming in from Lars Wingefors, who is the Embracer CEO. He was speaking to GamesIndustry.biz, and he said there is a long list of things that he would have done differently if he had his time again. You know, it's easy to look back in hindsight. And he said, I'm sure I deserve a lot of the criticism, but I don't think my team or companies deserve all the criticism. I could take a lot of the blame myself, but ultimately I need to believe in the mission we set out and that is still valid. And we are now enabling that by doing this, the three-part company structure. So the only problem is whenever someone like that, you know, like the CEO say stuff like that, you're like, yeah, they had a plan in the past that went very wrong. So yeah. The plan, and I'm sure this is a plan for the future, but you know, everything can change. So fingers crossed for Embracer's new three company structure, whatever it is.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an admission of guilt, not a big one for a company that has fucked up in as significant a way as Embracer have appeared to under his leadership. You know, you never expect to see a CEO drop to their knees groveling, you know, and apologizing. It's just not a thing they do. But you're right. There's an element of this that I'm like, I'm glad he said that he deserves a lot of criticism. But there's also an element of it's like him saying that, like, hey, hindsight's not 2020 and now we need to focus on the future. It's like, I don't know, that's just... Some of it doesn't sit right with me, but it never will, knowing the amount of people who lost their jobs as a result of how this company went about their business.
Yeah,
and how they expanded, and how, you know, stable the growth actually ever was.
Agreed. You know, it's all nice and happy when everyone's making mega bucks, but then when you start firing everyone and closing companies and stuff, it's not quite so cheery, is it?
Yeah.
Well, let's. We've got a small, interesting tidbit story just to finish us out for today, but may affect a lot of people out there. I, for one, have never taken advantage of this specific loophole, probably because I didn't know it existed, Jamie. But Valve have announced that they have, or they announced they were closing, and I believe today have closed a refund loophole that Steam had that effectively meant that you could buy a game in early access and play it as much as you wanted and get it refunded because the game hadn't come out yet. So that you didn't have to stick to their typical 14 days since released and only 2 hours played policy that, Steam have, which is a very generous refund policy they have. If you play a game on Steam and you've only had it for a couple of days and you've played an hour of it, whatever the reason, you can get a refund, which is a lot more user-friendly than, let's say, someone like Sony.
who don't even have a refund policy at this stage, it feels like, from ROMs.
Absolutely. But no, it was a little bit silly that the loophole allowed for people to effectively buy a game in early access, play as much as they wanted. Yeah. But because that game hadn't technically released yet, they could just say, hey, I don't want this game for whatever reason and get a refund. Because realistically, I think the people this is going to hurt the most will be smaller like indie developers who put a game out there in early access, hoping to get some of that fan feedback, hoping to get some monetary help in maybe finishing development of a game and actually finally to get it out.
Did this apply to games in early access, like across the board, like traditional early access, or was, because I was reading a lot of about this idea of advanced access, you know, how games might offer you as a pre-order incentive or as an incentive for buying a more expensive version of the game, 72-hour early access to that title. Hey, start playing the game a day early, 2 days early, 3 days early. I was reading a lot about people taking advantage of those kinds of deals because it was a retail product, but it wasn't technically out yet, so that the hours that they were putting in weren't accumulating, opposed to kind of like something like Kerbal Space Program that was in early access for like 10 years.
Ah, see, I read it as though it was like any game that was in early access, you could play as much as you want and then just get it refunded. Maybe my reading was wrong. Okay, let me quickly just read. I'm going to just have a little read here and see if...
I wasn't sure. Because I only read the one article on it, and it was talking about that kind of... You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, right, yeah. No, no, I see,
more and more advanced access to a game is kind of being used as a selling point. Or a reason to kind of pre-order or sell more expensive versions of games.
Okay, yes. No, thank you. I was incorrect. So it applies to not early access. It applies to advanced access. Yeah, so as Jamie said, as a little benefit, you know, oh, you've pre-purchased this. You can play this game a couple of days early. And then it didn't matter if you played how much you played the game in that advanced access, you could refund it. Not that because you hadn't technically been released yet. So no. Thank you,
because I think games that come out in early access have technically come out, but games that are like retail products that have a set release date that they give you advanced access to haven't.
Right.
That's my loose understanding of it, but I may have even butchered some part of that as well.
Although, see, this is what confused me, because there is a quote from Valve saying, for example, if you purchase a game that is in early access or advanced access, any playing time will count against the 2 hour refund limit. If you pre-purchase a title which is not playable prior to the release date, you can request a refund at any time prior to release of that title, and the standard 14-day, 2-hour refund period will apply starting on the game's release date. So that's what confused me about whether it applies to early access as well as not
I think the thing is, just because a game's in early access doesn't mean it hasn't released. It has.
It's just early access.
An early access version. Whereas, like, when the Suicide Squad is out on, you know, the 2nd of February, but you can start playing on the 31st of March, it's actually not out yet.
Right.
Whereas when a game enters early access on the 31st of March, it is out. It's just that early access form.
Okay. But it doesn't matter now because it's all closed.
Like we talked about, you mentioned No Rest for the Wicked.
Yeah.
When we were chatting before, like, if you go, I'm going to pull up Steam and see what it says. So yeah, when you go onto Steam and look at No Rest for the Wicked, which is a game that is now out in early access, its release date is the 18th of April, 2024. It doesn't say NA or unspecified future date. So an early access game, and this could still apply, weirdly enough, to a game that sold or offered advanced access to the early access launch. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like if no Rest for the Wicked had said, "Hey, there's a version that's $10 more that lets you start playing 2 days early," then that could have been a case where this was applying to an early access, advanced access for an early access game.
No, I think you're right.
Early access in general, I think, is just a term of phrase for like a game that is not in 1.0 yet.
Right, it was throwing me because in some of their quotes they're quoting early access and advanced access. They're kind of putting them together. But from what I've read now, a couple of extra articles, and they are specific. It seems they're specifically talking about advanced access, whilst they are still throwing in early access as well. I think they're trying to say that they've aligned
the thing that was like a red flag for me was if there had been a refund loophole around early access games, then we'd be talking about a loophole that existed for like decades. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
Whereas, like, advanced access is becoming more common, but like, yeah.
Okay, here you go. So this is another quote from Valve. Okay, so hopefully this will sort it out. And this is why it keeps throwing me, because they keep throwing in early. I don't know why they're throwing in early access. They said, when you purchase a title on Steam prior to the release date, the 2-hour playtime limit for refunds will apply, except for beta testing. But the 14-day period for refunds will not start until the release date.
Yep.
For example, if you purchase a game that is in early access or advanced access, any playtime will count against the 2-hour refund limit. If you pre-purchase a title which is not playable prior to the release date, you can request a refund at any time prior to the release of that title, and the standard 14-day 2-hour refund period will apply starting on the game's release date. So yeah,
see, that doesn't seem confusing to me at all.
No, this doesn't. This is them clarifying. This is them now because people I think have said, "Hold on, what does this actually mean?" And they've clarified. So that I think is black and white now. So we punch it. But it doesn't tell me is whether before you could do it on an early access game, which is what was
done. Again, I would be shocked if this was a loophole that applied to early access.
Let us know.
I know Space Program has been in early access, was in early access for like 3 decades.
It seems
highly unlikely to me that they're shutting that loophole now.
Should I go onto Steam quickly and try and get a refund for an early access game that I've had for a couple of years? But no, do you know who will know, Jamie? Our amazing viewers, patrons, and Discordees. So someone, whatever the platform, you can get in contact with us.
We don't need clarification.
I do.
No, not now.
I'm
weird about it.
I want to know previously to the closing of the loophole. Someone, just
so obvious.
For my sake. Hey, I'm doing a call to action here, all right? I'm drumming up comments. Okay. I'm making engagement. Stop ruining it. Correct me or let me know exactly what the state of affairs was before the closing of the loophole. Answer the question: could you refund an early access game if you play more than 2 hours?
I'm going to put out a tweet later. It's going to have a picture of your face. It's going to have a picture of a Steam early access logo. It's going to have a picture of the Valve logo, and it's going to have a picture of Cillian Murphy.
I was going to say.
It's going to be up to the audience to decide what's really going on.
It's got to have an image of Cillian Murphy in there. Hey, if you want to let me know, if you want to help me out like that, there's a number of ways you can do it. You can get in contact with us on YouTube or at Twitter at Super Show Pod, or you could go onto our Discord by joining our Patreon for as little as $2 a month. We are at, I can't remember what it is. We are patreon.com/supershow. And you can tell me the answer to my burning question. There we go.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. In advance for helping me out there. And ignore Jamie. Look, he's trying to make me sound stupid just because I don't know.
You do all the heavy lifting in that department, my friend. I just sit here and listen.
Ain't that the truth? But hey, look, thank you for joining us for another amazing show. Every week I just get excited about sitting down for a couple of hours with this man and talking about video games, and all of you who are joining us in the chat and join us afterwards as well. So thank you so much. You can catch us maybe the same time next week, probably the day earlier. We'll see. Apart from that, the only thing left for me to say is thank you very much and goodbye.
See ya.